He said, I'm going to do this solo thing and then I'll bring you all in. So he starts doing the solo piano thing. And I had never heard a piano played like that. It was just scary. And I'd seen lots of great jazz players, right? That, you know, loved Oscar and Ray stuff and Bill Evans. I'd see every night at the Vanguard. Dr. Johnson is playing this New Orleans thing, this solo. And I wanted to run from the stage. I don't need to be here. I'll be in the dressing room.
What's up, folks? Happy New Year and welcome to episode 101 of the Bass Shed podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. I hope everybody had an enjoyable holiday season. Things were pretty low key. Things were pretty low key for me. I did go back to Phoenix for a little bit, hung out with my family. My folks are back there. My sister's back there. My brother lives out here, but we both went back to hang out in Phoenix for a couple days. That's always cool. It's always a little surreal every time I go back to my hometown. You know, you see how the city changes and things and all the little things you don't even think about. Things I don't even think about. Like, I'll be driving through a specific part of the neighborhood. All of a sudden, all these memories come back. It's always kind of a surreal experience. But I had a great time while I was there. This year, for New Year's Eve, was probably the first year in, like, 20 years I did not have a New Year's Eve gig. And I was kind of okay with it. I didn't miss the whole thing. Obviously, as we all know, like, New Year's Eve gigs pay way better, so that part's always cool. But I enjoyed finally having a New Year's Eve off and just hung out and did not go out. It was raining here in Los Angeles. Just didn't do anything. Like, actually, that day, me and my brother watched college football. Which, for anybody that watched the college football, like, the TCU-Michigan game was insane. So we watched that at this little place over in West LA. And then we just hung out the rest of the night, and that was it. That was New Year's Eve. That's how I rang in the new year. It was pretty fun. Pretty fun to just not do the thing, not do the gig. You know, where you got to go set up at, like, 5. You got to go, like, set up at 5. Do the sound check, do the whole thing, and then you're waiting. You don't go on till later, and then you're finally done, and, you know, just dealing with traffic and all that at the end of the night. Like, yeah, happy to have had New Year's Eve off. All right, what else is going on? Bass Shed Academy. Okay, so this is starting to take a really nice shape. You know, the more I was thinking about it, I can't just start, like, a lessons program, even with some of the things that are going to be coming up with the remote lessons from guys all over the country, and things like that. That's really exciting. I did have to kind of bump that back a little bit, only because, as I typically do, I took on way more than I could handle at one time. So we're looking at, like, April to release a lot of the remote lessons with the other teachers. Well, but I also was thinking about, like, what on the local level, you know, on any local level, not just in Southern California. I think that there's this hole in the bass community. And that hole is that for the kids in, like, middle school to high school, I know some colleges have, like, popular music courses and stuff like this. But really, like, when kids are young and probably just beginning to start playing the bass, and from talking to all these people, all these bass players on the podcast that I have, you know, so many of us have gotten into the instrument, you know, in the teenage years, and there's no real way to get plugged in the school system, you know, like, where you can kind of play with other people, unless, and I do think this is also why the bass player journey is typically, like, you know, the extra guitar player in a band. Like, ah, dude, we got two guitar players. We don't need you, so why don't you play bass? And a lot of bass players stumble into the instrument that way. But I don't think there's enough representation in schools and stuff to let young people, prospective bass players, know what this instrument's all about. So that has become one of the agendas of the Bass Shed Academy, is to go into the local school systems and do some presentations and do some playing and bring some different guests, performers, and teachers in to the school systems to kind of let these kids know that, like, you don't have to play in the jazz band at school and you don't have to play in the orchestra at school to still do something with this instrument or be creative. Like, who knows if they're ever going to continue on playing. I think the amount of people that start an instrument during that age, I don't know what it would be, but the percentage of those folks that continue on with the instrument later in life, probably not a big percentage, but I think that the bass itself should be better represented to those kids and in those platforms. I don't know if there's a platform, but these kids should know about it. You know, they should know more about a little bit of the history of the instrument. I don't got to dig all the way into like some Leo Fender schematics. you know, I don't think they're interested to know how Leo Fender was winding his pickups. But I do think that a little bit more press for the bass can be a good thing to kids in the middle schools and in the high schools, if they're not going to be interested in the jazz band or playing classical. So that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing with the Bass Shed Academy, in addition to the lessons at Lemur Music and in addition to the remote lessons. That launch party is coming up still this weekend, January 7th. We're going to have the launch party for the Bass Shed Academy at Lemur Music. Thankfully, some folks have already signed up and RSVP'd. Really looking forward to that. Really looking forward to the weather being cooperative. Right now it looks overcast, so we might have to make some amendments, because as it stands now, we're going to be headless, little outside tent, and me and some of the other instructors, they're going to be doing some performances. So that's a little bit of how the Bass Shed Academy is taking shape. Getting a new website together for specifically just the Academy, and going to be making some amendments to the Bass Shed website. And I will keep you all updated on that. Speaking of the launch party at Lemur Music for the Bass Shed Academy, I will be headed down to Lemur Music tomorrow to meet with another bass player, David Grisman's son, Sam. If you guys remember, I'm going to have to look it up. Now, this is embarrassing. Like, I really should have done my own homework on my own podcast here. I believe, let's see if I'm accurate, huh? We're going to play a little game here. I think it was episode 32 that Jim Kerwin was on. And that's all I'm looking up, is the episode Jim Kerwin was on. Because Jim Kerwin played with David Grisman and Jerry Garcia. Oh, episode 33. Man, I was close. Episode 32 was Trevor Jones. So, yeah, on episode 33 was my talk with Jim Kerwin, who played with David Grisman and Jerry Garcia in that project. And tomorrow I'm headed down to Lemur to chat with David Grisman's son, who is a bass player and has a group and is looking to do some small little tour dates around Southern California. He's going to be down at Lemur getting his bass worked on, and I'm going to go down there and hang. Yeah, so that should be fun. Check out lemurmusic.com for everything you need for the double bass. There's also information there on the site about the Bass Shed Academy. So for double basses, stop by lemurmusic.com. Use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off. On the episode is bassist Tony Garnet. Tony has played with Bob Dylan for quite some time. It's been kind of his main gig. Tony joined Bob Dylan in 1989. That's a good run. That's a good run to play with a legend. Now, in addition to playing Bob Dylan, Tony has also worked with Tom Waits, Paul Simon, Asleep at the Wheel, He's done some movie soundtracks, which he will talk about. That's really fascinating to me. And played with the Saturday Night Live band. So Tony gets around. Originally from Minnesota, Tony spent some time in New York. He also spent some time in Southern California. He's in New York right now. And he was in New York when we recorded this. It was a great time. And now here's the thing. Tony, I just met Tony for this interview, but I've been hearing about Tony almost since I started the podcast. Dan Lakin for years was telling me, like, dude, you got to get Tony, man. You got to get Tony on the podcast. All right, cool. I'll get Tony on the podcast. The folks down at Lemur, very similarly, are like, yeah, we think Tony would be really good for your podcast, you know? And so this had been a long time in the works to talk to Tony, and Tony was recommended by two very different sources within the bass community. And so it was an honor to finally work this out. He had a very busy last year where he was on tour a lot. And so I'm glad it worked out for us to get together and have a talk here at the beginning of the year before he goes back out with Dylan. And here it is. Here's my talk with bassist Tony Garnet.
Hey,
Tony, you there?
Yeah, hold on. Let me just get this full screen here. Oh, I guess I don't have to. That's good enough. How you doing?
I'm well, man. How you doing?
Good. So one of my kids is like sleeping, so.
Oh, okay.
Teenage boys, right?
Oof. What ages?
He's going to be 18 in like.
Oh, wow.
A few days.
Oh, crazy.
And I have another one, a 15-year-old, but he's with his mother.
So. Okay, just the two?
And then I have a 1-year-old.
Oof.
I have one that's going to be one in like.
That's crazy.
I know.
That's crazy.
I have three boys.
Man.
But most of the time, the other two are with their mother.
18? The 18-year-old and the 15-year-old?
18 and 15, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have kids?
No. No, I'm. Not for me.
It's a lot. Yeah, I grew up with a big family.
Oh, yeah? How many? How many siblings?
Oh, there was like eight kids.
Oh, damn.
There was seven boys and one girl.
Wow.
I was like second oldest. My brother was before me, and then my sister was after me. So it was seven boys and one girl. I mean, it was a lot of boys. There's a lot of boys.
That's a rowdy household.
It's, you know, and I was reading about if a family has, say, a lot of boys, just the addition of one girl totally changes the whole chemistry, like gives it kind of a calming.
Right, grounds it a little bit. Right.
Yeah, because with the first two boys, me and my ex, we were reading about. It was a book called The Way of Boys.
The Way of Boys?
Yeah, The Way of Boys.
Okay.
And basically, with boys, they're very energetic, high energy. Yeah. And you kind of, it's like one of the first things it said, which was good advice, was you kind of have to let them just tire themselves out.
Yeah, let them run themselves out.
So there's a lot of, you know, I guess a lot of books on. You know, helping with raising kids and stuff. I don't know how my parents did it, and my dad's family, they all had like eight kids. My dad came from 13 kids.
Wow. And
they say it's actually easier having one kid is actually kind of hard because it's, you don't have another kid
to watch the one kid. Yeah.
Right. And I kind of believe that, but with the new baby, it might just be that might be good.
what's your ethnicity?
It's very mixed.
Yeah,
just everything. Yeah,
okay.
Just name something, and
it's probably in there. Yeah.
Actually, I know I haven't done a DNA test. My sister did, and there's a lot of. There's just so many things.
Are you interested in it?
I mean, I know some of it, but I just haven't done the research. I haven't done, and I know it's much cheaper now to do.
Yeah, yeah. There's so many, kind of, so many services. I think
you just
for
do
it.
A swab or something, and you could send it in. It used to be like, you know, $1,500 or something. Now I think you can do a DNA test for a couple hundred bucks now.
Yeah, yeah. So all the
maybe I'll do it because if she's done it, they say one. I don't know if any other male in my family has. Any of my brothers have done it. They said, if the girl does it, then at least one guy has to do it.
Okay.
For it to really even out, for it to make sense.
Huh.
So I'll probably do one.
Huh? All right.
We were born in Minnesota, and there's everything but Scandinavian in our blood. And my sister did a DNA test, and she found that she had 29% Scandinavian.
29%.
We didn't know where wow. that came from.
Huh. That's so bizarre.
I know.
Yeah.
I don't have any Scandinavian relatives.
Right.
My aunt that my mom was actually raised by, my Aunt Ernie, she had a boyfriend named Carl. This guy was Swedish, pretty old.
Okay.
Like, I don't know, I guess when you're 5 years old,
yeah.
anyone over 30 is old.
Not even 30, anybody in their teens is old.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So,
I think this guy, Carl, he seemed to be like he was 80.
Yeah.
He had an apple farm, and he would bring us these big bushels of apples. So he was Swedish, so I thought, wait, is Carl somehow our dad? Or your dad? But that was just a
That's hilarious. Thought. Man, you got quite the record collection behind you.
I know, and actually, I have a lot of records downstairs. I'm in the upstairs, one of the bedrooms here. And
yeah.
The records I've gotten in the last couple of years are downstairs, which I thought, I don't really need to buy any more records a few years ago, like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And now there's been a huge resurgence.
There's a resurgence.
I like having records, but to get, if you get a record on eBay or an older record, I mean, there's new records that are really nice, really great sounding, but if you get a anything that is old and you've had this record for years, and then you replace it with a one that someone really took care of. Because some of my records, I had a bad stylist for a few years, and it really damaged some records. And records do get damaged anyway when you play them. Like when you know, you make a recording, and I don't know if they still have it, but you get an acetate of your record, and you can only play it 10 times before it's worn out.
Oh, I didn't even know about that.
That's how needles work.
Okay. But
there's a company near me, I just found them recently, called Soundsmith. They make a turntable. You could play an acetate 100 times and it doesn't damage it. So none of your records would be damaged the way these guys turntables. So I went there because I needed a stylus on my turntable. It had gotten broken off. So I took my turntable to them, and they show me this turntable that they've made where instead of the weight being on the tone arm, there's no weight at all. I don't know how they do it, but it still tracks perfectly. It doesn't, you think, oh, this is going to skip. There's no weight.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no wear and tear on the rack. I'm not sure how much that turntable is or that I'm going to spend. But these guys have really researched this.
That's cool.
Incredible. And it's called Soundsmith in Peekskill. And they also are part of a charity that does these recordings, and they donate the money to a charity that is kind of helps kids who are basically sold into slavery
from
all over the globe. And so if you go on their website, Soundsmith in Peekskill, New York, you can find all the stuff they do with their children's charities. So that's my cool plug.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's my one charity.
Do you support the charity?
I do. I do. And I didn't know till I went in there to have this turntable.
Oh, yeah.
And the guy said, listen, if you're ever interested in coming here and doing a recording, audio files, love these records. We did one with Bill Frisell, did one. There's been a few people that have done these recordings there. And so people pay for these recordings. They're very exclusive. And they have money to cover the production costs. And then the rest they donate.
Oh, that's great.
To their charity. Yeah. So
very cool. What are you listening to in your free time? Well, also, by the way, I haven't said it to you. Happy New Year. Happy New Year.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Yeah.
How was your New Year?
It was okay. This was the first year I was off that I didn't have a gig in like 20 years. And I kind of loved it.
That is so funny because this is the first gig I had in 20 years.
Oh, really?
It's like, we're like Bizarro World, right?
Yeah. New York, LA. Right, you got the gig, I don't have a gig.
I started playing New Year's Eve. I grew up in Redondo Beach, right?
Okay.
After we were in Minnesota, we ended up in Redondo. And
it's lovely down there now. What was it like back in the day?
It was great. I feel so lucky that we
Yeah, that whole little area, like Manhattan Beach, Redondo Beach, that's all. I love it.
It's incredible. And when we first got out there from Minnesota, to see the Pacific Ocean, and the first beach I think I swam at was in Venice Beach, where my aunt was a haircutter. But then we ended up going to Redondo Beach in Hermosa and just seeing the Pacific there, like you come over this hill, 190 Street Hill, and like the Pacific is like, it looks like it's just bubbling out of the earth, right?
Yeah.
And when I see it now, I still get that same feeling as when I was 10 and saw it for the first time. I still look at the Pacific and go, wow, it's so great. But
it is.
A couple of my brothers surf. One of my brothers surfs every single day.
Oh, wow. He's still out here?
Yeah, I have a few that are still out there. But the one that surfs, he skateboards. He's doing everything that you it's a lifestyle.
Yeah, the whole Southern California lifestyle.
Being a musician or whatever, a lot of stuff is centered around being available when the big waves come in.
Right.
Whole job is like, he works overtime. He works really hard. And he's had an agreement with his boss that he would do all this extra work so when the big swells come in, he can be out there for 3 days.
All right. Where was your gig? Where was your New Year's Eve gig?
It was in the city. So I'm like an hour and a half from the city. And it was down in Tribeca at a hotel called the Roxy Hotel, a great hotel. And I was playing with, there's a filmmaker named Abel Ferrara, who's done a bunch of movies that I've played on the soundtracks. With his composer Joe D'Elia, who helped play with David Johansen and the Buster Poindexter thing and all that. So Abel likes to do gigs every once in a while. And so it was an Abel Ferrara gig at the Roxy Hotel.
Okay.
Abel, Joey, and a drummer named Danny McDermott, guy I've played with a lot, a singer, Paul Hipp, who is a great singer and actor, is in a lot of TV and movies, and been in Abel's movies, played Buddy Holly on Broadway. And so it was a fun gig. Just right at midnight, we played from 10 to 11:30, then we played New York, New York at midnight. And when we weren't playing, they had loud music. So
yeah, like loud club music.
The gig ended, and I'd left my earplugs in a room upstairs. And I'm trying to pack up, just being pounded. But people had a good time, and it was a fun gig. But I started playing like you. When we play New Year's Eve, we get more money.
Yeah, of course.
Been that tradition forever. And I started playing New Year's Eve when I was 14 at this place, Tony's on the Pier in Redondo Beach.
Okay.
We were, all my whole family pretty much worked there. I think it's still there. And you would start as a dishwasher when you were, like, I was 13, started working there. So then we started playing New Year's Eve, me and my brother. So my first New Year's Eve gig was like, let's see, how old am I? So like 20 years ago. No. Like 1970, right?
Right.
I played every New Year's Eve. And then it kind of stopped.
Right.
Like with DJs and I don't know, probably more like 30 years ago. So I only played it probably a couple times in the last 30 years on New Year's Eve.
Okay.
But it was a long day. And
yeah.
But Abel sang, a girl, Karen Scuderi, and Paul. And so we had three singers and great band. And so it was a lot of fun. Just rock and roll and whatever.
Just calling tunes that everybody knew?
Yeah, kind of. Paul would just start, hey, this is in G, and sing some Beatles song or Buddy Holly or Little Richard or Jerry.
Yeah, okay. Lewis. Okay, that, something you can like hear your way through or you know.
Stuff I knew that you kind of, I grew up playing. I know people nowadays grow up playing different, way different.
Yeah. It's a whole different vibe. Two things. I pulled up that film director's stuff. He's done a ton of movies.
Abel Ferrara,
like, oh my god.
One of his guys was at the gig, a guy he started doing films with. The first one I did with Abel was called King of New York, that I was actually in. Was
in 1990, I see.
Yeah. So I did, it's actually
You were in it? You were a character
we were
in
playing.
It?
Buster Poindexter had a scene where we were playing.
And oh, you're in the band. You're in the on-screen band.
Like
okay.
Back, yeah. And then, but then I played on some of the soundtracks recently, and I've missed a few. But when they showed some of his movies a couple of days before, one of them was Chelsea on the Rocks, which is about the Chelsea Hotel.
Mm.
And he said on this showing of movies that they just showed the last couple of days, that got the most amount of press.
Really?
Because people were interested in what went on at the Chelsea Hotel and Sid and Nancy and all that stuff, right? And so that one was just one of those movies where I think there was no real score. That one we kind of just ad-libbed to the scenes.
Oh, really? That's kind of a cool way to do it.
I've done before. I did that with, in fact, the first time I did that was to a Jim Jarmusch movie. We had music that John Murray had written, but there were some scenes that were just ad-lib, and I had never done that. And so the first one was Down by Law.
Okay.
And that was a couple scenes where you're just watching it and you're just feeling the scene, and it takes a couple takes, but you just want to get the you know, match whatever's going on.
Where would you go? Like, who were you? What were you trying to lock in with? Like, what character? If there's two characters.
There was one scene I remember where Tom Waits is on a curb, I think, in Down by Law. And he's, I forget exactly what happened. He came out and he's just kind of a little sad and maybe depressed. I forget exactly, because I haven't seen the movie in a while.
Okay.
But I remember just when Jim Jarmusch said, okay. Yeah, that's it. That's perfect. But you have to really immerse yourself in this. You can tell when music really doesn't match a scene, if it's way too much or not quite enough.
That's the right emotional content.
Not quite enough, but then to overpower a scene. But I've done that on a few occasions where you're just totally ad-libbing to a scene or playing the score, and John Lurie had written a lot of music for Down by Law and other things, Mystery Train, Get Shorty.
Okay.
Got to play in a lot of soundtracks that John had written. But now these Able things are Able is that's all. And it was funny that Jim Jarmusch was at the gig the other night, New Year's Eve.
Yeah?
I hadn't seen him in a long time. Yeah.
That's hilarious. So
that was great to see him. And but Abel's movies are different kind of films where there's a lot of, you kind of have to think of, you can interpret some of the scenes in your own way, like songs.
Okay.
You have to just kind of, okay, well, it's not in your face, like, okay, this is what happened. This is what's going on. Like the one we just did, Padre Pio, was at the Venice Film Festival. So I was doing a gig in Denmark, flew to Venice, my first time in Venice, which was great. And then,
where'd you fly into? There's no, I live in Venice. There's no airport here. Well, there's Santa Monica, I guess. That's probably
no, the Venice in Italy.
Oh, I don't live in that Venice.
That's so funny because I started talking about Venice in California.
Yeah, you were talking about Venice. Now I'm talking about Venice in Italy.
That's
a way better Venice, the one you're talking about that you flew to. Way better Venice.
Incredible. It's so great.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, I've been to Europe so many times and I had never been there, and I came from the airport in a taxi, you go over the bridge, welcome to Venice, and then you get in a water taxi to actually get to Venice. I mean, you're in, you know.
So were you in a gondola while you're at the film festival?
I never got in a gondola. But they're everywhere. I mean, you see guys in the gondolas taking people everywhere, and it's
kind of cool.
But you look at, you're in the water heading to wherever your drop-off point is, and then you walk to wherever you're staying, and you're looking at these buildings, and the water is like here's the bottom of the building, here's the water.
Just below.
And it's crazy. Coming up, and the first thing I thought is, how do people live like this? This is incredible. This is so great.
Yeah,
so fantastic. And one thing that was in Venice was there's a antiquities museum. And I was off, this is the most famous square, San Marco Square, and right off of that there's a church where they do concerts with period instruments, but a couple blocks away there's an antiquities museum of ancient instruments. So I go in this museum, and they've got violins and cellos, and there's like an altar with three basses up there. And
is the museum specific to Venice? Is it all?
Yes, it's a
Venetian and Italian instruments.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I go and I look at, you know, his instruments behind glass, and then the three basses sitting there on the stage. So I'm starting to leave, and then I said to the woman, I said, that's an Amati bass. I said, that's incredible. I've never seen an Amati bass. There's probably only a few in the world. And she said, yes, and the owner of the basses, I said, and usually they're behind glass and they're cracked, and it's sad. You see instruments that I always think they should be played.
Yeah.
And I said, it's great just to see them out in the open. And she said, well, thing is, they have to be played like every day, just about. And I go, really? Where do I sign up?
I said,
well, how could I get to play one? And she says, well, you're a professional musician. I said, yeah, I'm a bass player. She said, I can let you up to play them. There was like a rope.
Yeah, of course.
Roped off, and it was behind this rope, these three basses. She said, I can let you play them. I said, when? She goes, come back in an hour, because there was a few tourists in there too.
Okay, right.
So an hour later, I came back, and she said, yes, come up. And I said, could you take a picture of me playing?
Yeah,
a little video. So I played like this Amati bass, and I played these other two beautiful Italian basses. And then took some pictures, and the next day, Joey DeLeo, Abel's composer, and his wife came with me, and I'd noticed the pictures I took, I'm wearing shorts, and I said, I can't. I'm like insulting these bases.
Yeah, yeah. I can't go pictures. Out like that.
Could you guys take some more pictures of me? Yeah. So I went back and played and got
another
a
photo up
video. Yeah. And I said to the woman, I said, well, I've been in Italy many times, but never to Venice. I play tour Europe a lot with Bob Dylan. And she's like, Dylan. And she practically started melting.
Yeah.
And then that was the first day. The next day when Joey was there, I said, and this is Abel Ferrara's composer. And she's almost in tears.
Oh, yeah.
So great. Yeah. I forget. But I mean, you go to Italy and there's Italian bases.
Yeah.
They don't let them out of the country anymore. Anything over 100 years, I think they have
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, paintings, anything. They're holding on to their...
I kind of respect that.
Yeah.
Yeah, as long as they're doing a good job preserving it.
Well, I'd never heard of someone saying, oh, these bases have to be played. Have to be played with the
bases. Yeah, that's rare.
That's great. So...
What was first for you? What was did you start on upright or did you start on electric?
I started on clarinet.
I didn't see that one coming at all.
That was actually my first clarinet. And then in Minnesota, then we went to guitars because California was, we moved out there and 65 and it was just exploding with.
Was it just for drier weather to get out for the family to get out of the snow?
My dad was a carpenter, construction worker, and so in the winter the work would really slow down.
Yeah.
Sure. And with eight, well, we had seven at the time. It was tough, and the weather was really rough. The snow would just, like the snow they just had in Buffalo, we would get that.
Did that impact you where you're at in New York?
No, I mean, we didn't get any.
I heard about it.
We didn't get any snow, but it's terrible. Like, I don't know how many people died. It's really sad. It was a lot. But Minnesota would get, I remember it being 30, 40 below.
That's insane.
Below zero happened every winter, like a bunch of days.
Yeah.
So to go to California and then the be in and see the surf and then the whole music scene out there was just. But in Minnesota, my mom was a piano player and an organist, and she took us like the modern jazz quartet. I remember seeing like Seven and Harry Belafonte and seeing really great music then. But California was just exploding in 60s.
I mean, where you're at, like Redondo Beach, you know, whatever, the 60s?
Yeah.
Oof, what a time.
I know.
You know, that's like the heyday of this whole little what's going on over here.
And the Wrecking Crew stuff was all over the airwaves. So you were getting all this Beach Boys stuff and like a Rolling Stone was big on the radio and the Beatles.
Yeah.
And all those. I mean, it was top 40 music, but there was some really awful songs, but there were some pretty good ones. And then FM radio started happening. So then you started getting the band and Dan Hicks and Commander Cody and all kinds of San Francisco bands.
Yeah.
Just everything. And so I was...
I mean, you were out here when the Laurel Canyon thing was just going off, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that must have been a great time.
I wasn't old enough to get into any of the clubs, but I had friends. There's a drummer. There was a band called the Royal Teens. They had to change their name because there was another Royal Teens. There was another band called, you know, bands had, you had to have a name, the Indescribably Delicious. So both those bands were in Redondo in the South Bay. They played on the Sunset Strip.
Yeah.
They had made it. They were.
That was the big time.
And both those drummers from that band ended up in the Bay Area when I moved up there to go to school. And I played with both those drummers. One was Mark Cohen, who ended up playing with Tony Joe White and Byron Berline and a lot of people. And the other guy, Evan Zhang, helped found a big company called PetSmart. And so these guys, he always was Evan and still writes and sings. Yeah. But these guys were like, when we were like 12, 13, and you'd see these guys playing. And another guy who I'm in touch with, Lindsay Guerrero, had a band with his brothers, and you'd see them up on stage, and it made you think, well, maybe I could do that.
Was that kind of the beginning of jumping into bass, getting from guitar to bass?
Yeah, when I was like, I guess I started guitar when I was 12, me and my older brother, and then we were taking like theory lessons on piano and both learning guitar, but just for a few months before my brother said, hey, why don't you play the bass and we can start a band? And I remember going to someone's house and guy had this like white Fender precision bass, and to a little kid it's like, wow, look at that. I mentioned that to my brother recently, and I remember that guy Greg, he had that white Fender bass. He goes, yeah, that guy, he says, you I think you took his gig like a year later. Yeah, he was over. But luckily I got on the bass because it just immediately was like my thing. And
yeah,
within 2 months of going to the electric bass, my mom made me take up the upright, like in seventh grade.
Wow.
So I got on the upright in junior high, got a bass. I think I was able to bring a bass home.
Okay.
Guy showed me, Mr. Mallory, just showed me some how to hold the bow.
Yeah.
But I could read music because I had played clarinet, and we were reading. My mom could read anything. Yeah. She could play these old organs in church and just sight read four or five lines. It was crazy when I'd watch her play the organ and play the bass pedals.
Yeah.
She was just an incredible musician. And my dad always sang opera.
Oh, wow.
But so we were made to really learn to read and not become a great, great reader, but I could read playing school orchestra. And then they had a stage band at the high school. So back then, this is 1968, 69, there's no upright bass players. Guys are playing either, there's no kids like my age playing upright bass.
Sure.
Nobody in my whole area. So I would go from the junior high to the high school. In high school, I would go to the junior college and play.
You had all the school gigs.
All the gigs. Playing, you know, with the orchestras or the Broadway shows they put on at El Camino. And then I was playing on the street a lot with guys showed me bluegrass and jug band music. And
okay.
I was listening to some jazz, but mostly playing everything. Playing with my brother and basically electric bass, playing rock bands, playing like Cream and Hendrix and stuff like that. And people in Redondo Beach, there was a lot of cool musicians in Redondo that we played with. So I kept really busy.
Does your brother still play?
He just retired from playing recently. He has a jazz radio program that he does in
awesome.
Louisiana and Lafayette. Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Oh, he's always been, he's been in Louisiana for years, involved at the university. And, but he played Zydeco music and music. And
so he's deep in the Louisiana culture of it all.
Really deep.
Yeah.
I mean, who writes on the family text? He's always writing these things in French. So I'm going, what is that? Not French, but like Creole French.
Right. Like the street French.
He really delved into all the stuff down. So he played with these Zydeco and Cajun bands, and he really knows a lot of the historical things that happened with hundreds of years ago.
Yeah. He's,
but he does a jazz radio program. His name's Dejama.
Okay.
And he's very knowledgeable guy, but he had to, he quit touring a couple of years ago because.
Who was he touring with?
He was touring with a band. The last band he played with was a band called Jeffrey Brassard and the Creole Cowboys. And they're a great Zydeco band. And he was in a band called Philae before that. But there was a fiddle player named Canray Fontenot, who's like one of the last of this style of fiddle.
Okay.
Creole fiddle. And so my brother was friends with Canray and was actually a pallbearer at his funeral.
Oh, wow.
Canray was recording in the 20s, and Philae even went on tour. He went on tour with Philae, and my brother roomed with Canray. So if anyone knows about this style of music and you mention Canray Fontenot, they just, their eyes glaze over. Wait, your brother knew Canray.
Right.
So it's stuff that's, it relates to country music and
yeah,
deep, you know, regional stuff.
Sure.
Oh,
but what were some big influences on you?
Oh, I want to tell you.
Oh,
also,
yeah, go ahead.
My brother Dejan, not only does he play fiddle, he would play great guitar on any of these bands and bass.
Oh, so, wow. He's, upright and electric?
He never played upright bass, but
okay.
He started playing violin when he was 5 in Minnesota. And
wow.
He ended up, my brother went on tour when he was 9 or 10. My mom flew him to Mexico, and he joined a mariachi band from Monterrey, Mexico.
Wow.
And they toured the whole U.S. So when they got to Minnesota, my mom sent me to Duluth or somewhere to get on their bus. It was a priest, Father Alvarez, and it was orphans.
Uh-huh.
They were called Mariachi Infantil, something like that. So I go to somewhere, jump on their bus just to ride with, just so my mom, I guess, would get rid of me.
Yeah, for the, what was this, for like the summer or something?
Yeah, it was the summer.
Okay,
so
yeah.
Their bus for like,
she's not going to send you on camp. She's just going to send you on tour with the mariachi band.
We would go to camp 1 year. I went to a farm a couple times. it was such
literally
a
great, farming you out.
She really knew how to do for things for us to do. So I end up on this bus with these mariachis, and these guys were incredible. It was so just great. And my brother, who played fiddle in this mariachi band, they had like 2 or 3 trumpets. They had, I don't know how many violins, guitaron.
Yeah.
This folklorical dancing, girls with those kind of dresses.
Yeah.
And a clown, which is
really
the mariachi thing. You got a guy doing like funny dances.
I didn't know that.
And they have singers that will do this drunk thing, you know, the drunken singer.
Okay.
This mariachi thing. I remember with Charlie Sexton, we were in Guadalajara once, and we went to a bar called the Mariachi. And I said, and it was really great. I mean, this is the top mariachi, and mariachi music is beautiful. I love it. And these guys are so good. And I said, they do this drunk thing every once in a while. And the very next song, the guy's like, and it's just, it's beautiful. And my brother went on tour really when he was 9. So
that's hilarious.
And I learned mariachi, and now I still listen to mariachi music, and it's just very emotional for me.
That's cool. Do you understand? Like, do you speak Spanish?
No, I don't understand.
You're just hearing his melody lines.
Yeah, I've looked up the translations.
Okay.
Some of the songs like La Negra and you know, the real famous songs. And I love a lot of mariachi music. Like the guy Vicente Fernandez, he just died a couple of years ago. He was like one of the real kings, and he came to New York and filled the garden, apparently.
Really?
I didn't know about him till 15 years ago. And so I've seen old black and white clips of Vicente Fernandez that are just, it's just amazing. And what I loved about it, it's just emotional. It's very emotional music. Mm-hmm. Like we did a tour with Bob Los Lobos.
Okay. Early,
like 91 or something. And we were in Guadalajara. And after the gig, there was a party. And I could hear a mariachi band. And one of the promoters, the girls, I said, are you going to, I said, there's a mariachi band. She says, yeah. I said, oh, I'm going to, I said, are you going to go listen? She goes, no, I cry when I hear it. It's so sad. But those guys, Caesar and David Hidalgo and Conrad, they were playing with them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They've sat in with the mariachis.
So are all these tunes kind of tragedies? Like, is that why, or is it just emotional? Are they sad, or is it just like really passionate no matter what the message?
They're sad, but they're love songs. And they're, okay. And in the mariachi bars, they'll sing every pop song will be played like a mariachi
style.
Yeah,
yeah.
But it's just like the way the fiddles and the sound of the trumpet and that singing style is kind of a forlorn.
Right.
It's kind of that way even with Norteño music. I remember I played a little bit with Flaco Jimenez years ago with Peter Rowan doing mm-hmm. bluegrass and then doing Flaco stuff. And a lot of those Norteño songs are sad because it's about what's still going on. People trying to come over the border.
Right.
For work. They're over here, but then they missed their families back home. And then they're going to get arrested and end up in jail. And it's a lot of tragic.
Yeah.
A lot of tragic songs. But it's beautiful. Beautiful music.
Do you write?
A little bit. I've written some things. I mean, I used to write more, but I'm trying to finish some a documentary right now.
Really? So that's more like, I mean, writing is composing, but
I don't write lyrics. I've never been a lyric writer.
Okay, but you're doing all the music right now. You're working on the music for a documentary?
Yes.
What's the premise of the documentary?
Well, I don't want to say because it's been going on for a while.
Okay.
I should be finishing with it soon. So.
Okay. Is it like a pop culture thing or a politic thing or like just what's kind of the scope of it?
It's more, I don't really want to.
Okay. No, I get it.
I'm actually involved in like a number of projects right now that I can't discuss.
You can't talk about it at all.
I can only discuss about stuff like
yeah, that's already out in the world.
I mean, I have some cool stuff coming up, and then I think the Bob tours, Bob Dylan tours. We've been doing this last record, Rough and Rowdy Ways, and that's been really great. And so that's,
you were on the road for a good part of last year, right?
Yeah, we started back in last November.
Yeah,
and did probably 100 shows over the course of the year. But we're off for like 2 months, 3 months at a time.
Yeah.
We'll go out and really do a bunch of shows. And
right, you really hit it hard while you're out
there. Four or five weeks.
So how did it feel going back on the road, pulling that many dates after the lockdown and there was no dates and you're home and everybody? I know for me, like I got really comfortable being at home and I became more of a homebody. And now just the idea of really leaving is a little bit more daunting. Like, yeah, Dad, I don't want to leave the house. I don't want to be away. Things like that. How did it feel for you after not touring for that year, going back out and pulling 100 plus dates?
Well, it was good to be out. And I mean, the thing about during the lockdown, I was able to figure out how to record myself and send
it. Yeah.
And start doing this film music stuff and practice. I never really get to practice. And there was a few gigs, so it was fun to practice and go play a few gigs here and there. But then to go on tour with Bob and to see the people who really wanted to hear music.
Yeah, yeah. and be see around it again. And yeah,
it was incredible. Sure. It was so great just to be out and play. It still is, because people are coming to the shows, and most of the shows are selling out. I think they're all selling out, and the reviews are really great. And this is a new record that people don't do tours and do the whole record. We want to hear some old songs. And
So this is all new material on this record?
Like the record we recorded a couple of years ago.
Cool.
And so to play like 9 of those songs, and then maybe 4 or 5 of the older.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty brave. Because when you see acts that have been around for a long time, people want to hear their
old. Yeah, the old stuff. Just the old stuff, yeah.
And Bob has never really done that. I've played a lot of his older songs, but then people want to hear him like the record, and he's never done him like the record anyway. So.
Right. So when you came out here and you were in Redondo Beach, when did you make the move back to New York?
I moved to the Bay Area to go to school.
Okay.
After high school, I went up to Berkeley. I went to Cal, and in the Bay Area, I started playing all kinds. There was so much music there. This is 1973.
Yeah.
So there had greatest bluegrass bands, great jazz, Bobby Hutcherson, people like that, John Handy. They had all that East Bay punk stuff. Power and Larry Graham and then the San Francisco bands and bands like Azteca and Charlie Musselwhite, blues guys. It's just incredible music. Everywhere you turn, there was just great music. So I got to school and immediately was on academic probation like the first quarter, because I was out playing.
Right.
I play with this band, this bluegrass band. I mean, I'm playing on the street. I can't really play in the bars because I'm 17. I was 17, I guess. And then in May of that year, I turned 18. But I'm 17, right? I can't play in any bars. Playing on the street. But I play this with this bluegrass band in Santa Cruz, and we open for Ramblin' Jack Elliott and the band Asleep at the Wheel.
Okay.
I heard of Asleep at the Wheel. And then so I see him for the first time after this bluegrass band from the Hog Farm, Wavy Gravy and all those. Right. So we all were Asleep at the Wheel. And I just thought, well, this is incredible. They're playing bluegrass, country stuff, and swing.
Yeah.
Berkeley playing jazz in their jazz department. And there's some great players there. There's a woman, piano player named Susan Muscarella, who started the California Conservatory of Jazz now. She's the president.
Oh, wow.
Combo with her, a great drummer named Kim Plainfield. It's sax player and a trumpet player, and we go to this jazz festival in Van Nuys, and we make it to the finals. Out of 100 schools, we're like one of the 5 combo finalists, and the judges are like Phil Woods,
right,
Clark Terry,
yeah, New York heavies,
Clara Fisher, they're all in L.A. now,
but, right? Yeah, West Coast.
So and Frank Rossellino, and they're the judges. So we did good, but I was in the Berkeley in that jazz department.
Frank Rossellino, man, that guy, what a sad story.
What happened with him?
Let me make sure this is the right guy. I think he was the guy who wrote the standard Blue Daniel that shot himself.
Blue Daniel is such a beautiful song.
It's a great song. That's the guy I'm thinking of.
Right? I got Phineas Newborn playing. Oh. Right? Is that Blue Daniel?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
I think that's the right thing. I'm trying to look this up quick. I don't know. I'll let you know.
Well.
Or it could be a different thing. I know it was anyway,
he was he was one of the judges.
Okay.
So I So I end up joining Asleep at the Wheel 6 months later.
Yeah, so quickly, he did. He shot both of his sons while they were asleep. One died. The other one survived but was blind, and then he shot himself.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's how he went. That's how he went out.
Pretty I never dark. Knew that, because Frank Marcellino was also involved with stuff that, like, Scotty LaFaro did. Mm. Right? I think he might have played with Scotty was there. With Richie,
I'm looking at his discography right now.
I don't know if they ever recorded together, but I just found out recently Scotty LaFaro, you know, he did a lot of his Woodshed and really playing was where I grew up, at the Lighthouse.
He played here, yeah.
Yes, in Hermosa Beach, because I used to go to the Lighthouse when I was, you could get in the Lighthouse. That was in, you didn't have to be 21.
Cool place.
Yeah, so apparently Scotty played there a bunch.
Yeah, in
the book that his sister wrote about him.
Yeah, there's a gentleman on the podcast. He's a London guy that coming through the States, like, met with LaFaro's sister and got to go to her house, and the sister showed Dave Swift where LaFaro used to practice, and Dave Swift was involved with that book that came out, Shades of Jade, a few years back.
Yeah. I love that book. That book is so great. She did such a great job.
Yeah, and I think that was the recording. Was that the recording with like these interviews with Bill Evans talking about how him and LaFaro would practice, or a recording of him and LaFaro practicing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my favorite.
Recording of them doing...
like talking through what they're going to do.
My Foolish Heart. There's a long practicing that and playing the changes. And I I love what Scotty LaFaro did. And the fact, like, a guy like Phil Palumbi, right, did all those solos of Scotty's, right? It's amazing. I mean, he really achieved something. And the best, there's some great parts of that book. One of them, the first one, is Don Thompson in the foreword, right? Says everyone wanted to be Ray Brown, which I still think Ray is still the king. He's the overall king of upright bass as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
Right? Because
I mean, I'm not going to disagree. I think Ray became the standard of what it means to be, but I think that there's some guys that are equally of that caliber, you know. George DeVivier, I think, gets overlooked. I think Sam Jones gets overlooked. PC gets some attention, but PC was the most recorded guy of the time.
And I never got to see Paul Chambers, and I probably listened to him even more than Ray Brown, but I loved all those Ray Brown Oscar records.
I
wanted to see Ray as a kid, and I didn't get to see Leroy Vinegar, but when Ray would just, I'm not talking about solos, what a bass player is doing as far as backing up someone playing, just walking bass.
Sure.
When you would see Ray just walk the bass, it was just prophetic. I've never seen anyone who could do that. And guys that I've, like, I never really studied with anyone. I'm mostly self-taught, but I got a lesson from Ray once. I got a lesson from Dave Holland one time. And I said, so Dave, well, who do you listen to? And he goes, I still go to listen to, like, Ray Brown. So both guys I talked to, Ray is still, to me, the top guy. Even though, so as far as just your doom girl, you know, guys like George Mraz, who just flipped over, Michael Moore, I studied with. Yeah. He was just a monster. And there's so many.
Did you study with Mraz?
I took a lesson from George.
Okay.
He was, because I saw him at Bradley's when I first moved to New York.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a great teacher, but, like, the way he played, I think he was probably one of the greatest bass players ever.
Mm.
You think, George?
I do. I'm a big fan of George Mraz's playing. And there's a... it's very much, you know, like, he does not do... He plays the tradition of jazz wonderfully, but you always hear this European thing in there also. And I really like that in his play.
Yeah. He was such a monster. I remember seeing him with Dizzy Gillespie at the Dizzy's 75th birthday or something. It was a month at the Blue Note. And he had a different rhythm section every week. So I go to see a week that George is playing bass. And they did Hot House or some pretty up-tempo. And George takes out the bow, and he wouldn't bow that much. But, man, he took this bowing solo where I was just falling on the floor.
Yeah.
And he was, I really liked George so much. He was just played perfectly in tune. He had such incredible chops. But he told me, Oscar, when he went out with Oscar, Oscar wanted him to play like Ray when it came to.
Oh, just doing time. That thing. Yeah.
He said, you got to dig in more. Oh, I don't know. And George said he had blood blisters on his fingers. he called Oscar one afternoon and said, he says, I have a fever in my fingers. I have blood blisters. Because Oscar wanted everyone like, I mean, that Ray thing was so strong.
Sure.
And Oscar said to George, okay, George, okay, so then for the matinee, you don't have to wear a tux.
That was the courtesy?
Yes. But I loved it. But so what I was going to say in Helene's book, she says, Don Thompson says, everyone wanted to be Ray Brown until Scotty LaFaro came along. And Ray's sitting there going, at some point in the book going, and they're going, don't you think this is too much? And Ray goes, I like what this guy's doing. And then when he died, when Scotty died, Ray said, this is going to set bass playing back 10 years or something like that, right? So,
yeah.
But, I mean, I've gotten to see, like, Ron Carter with a bunch of different people. And there's so many great bass players in New York that I've gotten to see once I moved here. So I joined this band, Asleep at the Wheel, moved to Austin for 5 years.
Okay.
And then I moved to New York at the end of 78. Really to concentrate on playing jazz.
Oh, interesting.
But it was because I would go to hear Bill Evans every night at the Vanguard. If I was on tour and came to New York, I would run to Bradley's. I would run to the Vanguard. I'd run to the Jazz Emporium, Boomer's, see Dave Holland, see all these, Richard Davis, Sonny Stitt, Dexter Gordon. All these guys were, I went to the cookery to meet Mary Lou Williams because my mom knew her, and I was going up to play with her in her apartment and went up there a few times. But the first time I met her, she's playing at the cookery. And so I wait till her break and then I go over to her table and I said, Mary Lou, I'm Peggy Bernier's son. Oh, great. Oh, yeah, New York. We can always use bass players. Here, sit down. This is Charles Mingus. So I meet Mingus. Yes. So I was going.
Oh my gosh.
I know. So I'm going up to Mary Lou's and then I was playing, you know, some pretty cool things. Now, just getting my feet wet with the jazz scene. And then I got a call from this singer, Robert Gordon, rockabilly singer. And he says, hey, Bruce Springsteen's bass player gave me your name. I need an upright guy who can play slap bass. And I could kind of do that.
Okay.
I go up there and he's got this big tour. I end up doing playing with Robert. And then I would come back to New York and play some jazz here and there, but never really got to really delve as much as I wanted to. And I still don't. I mean, I still do some jazz stuff. I've done some stuff with like Diana Krall, played on a couple of her records. And she's so great because she'll sing and then she plays these
great
solos. She's just swinging.
And it's all got a really nice laid back feel.
And the record I played on with her, she had, what's his name? The Kareem Riggins, who was Ray Brown's drummer.
Yeah.
So Anyway, I get to play a little bit of jazz. I was with a quartet with a sax player named Rob Sheps, who's a great saxophone player. And so I don't get to play as much as I want. And I never really was able to make a living solely as a jazz player. But the guys who do that, there's just such monster players.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what it's like in New York. I've never played out there other than doing some tours that went through New York. So I've never been on the New York scene, but it's got to be rough, you know, of all the young guys that are coming out of these major schools. Yeah. And everybody's such a strong player. And every year there's probably a new batch.
When I moved here, there wasn't, the school thing was not as strong. Now it really is. But
now the school thing is a big deal.
Who were just playing, who knew every song, right? Like I saw this thing with Michael Moore, this interview, and he said, yeah, you were expected to know every song. He goes, if a sax player sits in, he's going to call his song. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to know that. And so right. You try and find it. And a couple of times I was asked by like John Burr, great bass player. Yeah. He's playing at Bradley's with somebody. And he says, oh, you want to sit in? And I'm like, oh, I'm not quite ready. I don't know. And John Burr was a monster player. And, but like, guys, like, if you got on a gig with Jimmy Rolls,
right,
who knew every song,
everything, yeah.
I mean, there's a video of Oscar Peterson. Oscar Peterson has a show in Canada, and he has Jimmy Rolls on. He says,
okay,
Jimmy, people say you know all these songs. And Michael Moore told me, he says, yeah, we're asking Jimmy, just can you get a book together of your songs? And Jimmy was a big help to Diana Krall.
Okay.
And so she knew Jimmy. And Michael, they were trying to get Jimmy to get his songs in a book because he would just start playing. And a lot of these gigs, that's what guys do. They don't even call the song. They just start
going into it, yeah.
Playing. And Ron McClure was my first teacher in the Bay Area.
Okay.
I saw an interview with him and he says, that's what you would do. You'd be on the thing. A guy would start playing the song. And you would have to know what it is. And
yeah.
They would even tell you the title of the song. And that's what was expected. And the bass players had to know every song.
Right.
And so, man, it's tough. But they don't do that anymore. People have their songs and they don't know a million. And Jimmy Rolls on this Oscar show, Oscar says, you know more songs than anyone. Well, I don't know. And he really did. And he goes, including the verses, and which is true. Jimmy did know that. And Oscar says, like, do you know the verse of this song? And he starts playing a song. He goes, oh, that one I don't know. And Oscar's like, okay. And he goes, is it this? And he starts playing.
And he played it, yeah.
it's beautiful. So those kind of piano players are not really around.
Right.
Or that knew millions and millions of songs.
Yeah, I play with one guy that knows a ton of material. And we were both in the house band at a jam session together. And that became the game of the jam session, trying to stump this piano player. And nobody could do it.
Really?
Yeah, nobody could stump him. Like, he knew everything. He knew everything we called.
Wow. Where do you play at mostly?
Since the world opened back up, I don't as much anymore. I do some like fly dates and things with a trumpet player on the West Coast.
What were you doing before?
Oh, anything. Just working guy stuff, like, you know, whatever. Singer-songwriter thing at Hotel Cafe or a top 40 cover thing at a hotel or whatever, a jazz club, like whatever.
So when you were playing jazz clubs, so were you playing with people who would they have music or would they just start playing?
Sometimes it would be original material where you'd show up and they'd have charts or, you know, send out PDFs for people to put on an iPad or something.
Yeah.
Singers usually have their book of tunes they do with their key. And then if it's just like a quartet, it just called tunes, and someone will start something that we all probably know, and no one's really calling a tune at that right. point.
I guess the roughest time I had was I was playing with Ted Kersen, you know, who played trumpet with Mingus. Mm-hmm. At the Blue Note, he had these jam sessions after the regular shows at the Blue Note. Sure. And I don't know if they still have those, but you get up there and play, and a singer would come up, then a different horn players, and you'd basically play for 2 or 3 hours. And I did that for a few months, and it was great. I learned a lot of songs, but it was like intimidating when someone wants some weird song in like a weird key. Yeah. Right.
But man, doing those kind of like power sets must have got your chops together. Like just your stamina. Really
yeah.
Must have been amazing.
Yeah, and playing with what was another guy I played with? A guy named Willis Jackson, who kind of discovered Pat Martino.
Okay.
But Willis Jackson and Jack McDuff were, and Willis was also married to Ruth Brown. So I played with him a lot at this place called the West End.
Okay.
Cafe and a few things here and there, but I started playing a little more electric bass in the early 80s. I was always playing more upright, and then got to New York and realized, oh, I guess I gotta play more electric. So I started.
That's an interesting time to be in New York with an electric bass. I mean, that's the Jaco era of things.
Yeah. And so I started concentrating more on playing electric. Now I think I've always been more of an upright player, mm-hmm. but then I started playing more electric bass, and I would play with I remember playing one of the first guys that really scared me was Dr. John. Playing a gig with him who was a guitar player. I forget his name. Anyway, really heavy New York players, horn players, everyone. And Mac had his music, he had a book of his songs, but I knew Page and music and Zydeco and some New Orleans stuff, Fats Domino. But I didn't know the New Orleans funk thing. I didn't really know the Meters.
No, okay.
Like 81. That really was never a thing I had studied and played.
Yeah.
So, and Mac, that's what he does. And so he gets up there and he starts playing. First of all, it's the Lone Star Cafe. So it takes him 10 minutes to get down to the stage, and we're just vamping on Ico, right? Don't. Yeah. And then he comes on and he starts playing ding 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 ba ding, ding, ding Ico. I and you just hold on.
Yeah.
And it was so great. He was so good and just so soulful. And then he does this song. He's got so many great songs, but one song he did was a hit record for him, Such a Night. So in Such a Night, he does a solo thing in the middle of it. You know, Such a Night. And I'd never seen him do that.
Yeah.
I'd never had seen him play. I'm like playing on a gig with him. And he goes into the, when we'd rehearse, he says, I'm going to do this solo thing and then I'll bring you all in. So he starts doing the solo piano thing. And I had never heard a piano played like that. It was just scary. And I'd seen lots of great jazz players.
Sure, right? Sure.
You know, loved Oscar and Ray stuff and Bill Evans. I'd see every night at the Vanguard. Dr. Johnson is playing this New Orleans thing, this solo. And I wanted to run from the stage. I was I don't need to be here. I'll be in the dressing room.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It just scared me to death. He was so... And so I started playing more electric, and then started playing a lot of blues at Tramps, playing with Otis Rush. I got to play with Albert Collins, play with even with Escarita, who was an influence of Little Richard.
Okay.
And there was a lot of like Bo Diddley,
mm-hmm.
played with Chuck Berry, all those guys who would use pickup bands.
Yeah, yeah.
And now they're gone. I mean, they would have bands for certain periods of time. But in New York, they knew they could come in, get good players. And sure. So I got to play with Solomon Burke. And
oh, wow.
So many. Irma Thomas. And it was just
Amazing. Yeah, what was it? There was like, I forgot when it was.
They have this thing on Dionne Warwick on CNN right now. And I was watching it. I was like, wow, so she really crossed over. She could do. And I remember playing with Dionne Warwick. It was a tribute to Nancy Wilson.
Okay.
And then she said, and they were talking about Ashford and Simpson talking about her. And I got to play with them. I mean, there was so many cool people to play with. And I hadn't moved to New York to play jazz, but then I found
this whole other scene.
Lots of other stuff that where I could eat.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I was just never at that caliber as far as a jazz player where I really stuck to it and just made a go of just playing jazz. But I'm glad I got to play more electric and meet Jaco, lend him this bass here. Jaco, I lent this bass.
Oh, yeah.
This is a precision, right? A 65, right?
Okay, 65 that has fun. That has the mute on it, the dampener down by the bridge.
Yeah, I always put that on my bass. So, and I, you know, I use pretty heavy, like, action, like James jamming big.
Okay, you get the big sound.
So Jaco needed a, I don't use this bass that much, but it's, so Jaco needed a bass with playing with Mike Stern, and I was playing with Lenny Stern, and I go to their house, and Mike goes, oh, let's play. You want to play something? Waiting for Lenny. Okay. Now let's play this. It's like, just playing so fast. So I tried to play with him, but I played with Lenny a couple gigs at this place, 55 Christopher, that just closed now. So,
yeah, that's been, what was it, like 4 or 5 months ago, the 55 bar closed?
So Jaco needed a bass there one night with Mike Stern. So I said, okay. And I forget.
What year are we talking? Like, is this in the peak of his unraveling?
Be, yeah, it might be 84. Or
oh, yeah, okay.
Five or some, maybe.
Yeah, when you did all those punk jazz records there with Stern.
I don't remember exactly, but so I bring him my precision, and I brought in my polytone amp. I lent him amps, bass. So he takes this high action precision, and one of the first things they do is Donna Lee, and he does the Donna Lee thing,
On
his first record on this bass, like it's his jazz bass. But for like 10 minutes or 8 minutes, he soloed on this bass.
That's crazy.
Which is high action. Yes. I mean, he was such a monster player. It was to be able to see someone like that.
That's cool. Yeah,
he was out. It was sad.
Yeah.
When his drinking and whatever took over, because then he couldn't even get in. They wouldn't even let him in. I remember walking around with him in the village once, and they wouldn't let him into the Bottom Line. And I was playing there a lot with Buster Poindexter. And I said to the manager, they go, he can't come in. And I go, Jaco. And they go, we know who it is. No, he can't come in. They wouldn't let him in the Bradley's, the Lone Star. At the Bottom Line, I said, no, it's Jaco. We know who it is. Okay, you stay with him if he gets out of line.
Yeah.
And it was Bobby Bland playing and Jaco.
Okay.
As a, hey, like, so I buy him a drink, which I don't know why. Hey, Bobby, it's Jaco. And they make us leave. And they go, he's got to go. We were only there for 5 minutes.
Just did he harass Bobby, or was that it? He just
because he started yelling, they thought, okay, it's just going to get
worse. It's going to escalate. Yeah.
He's disrupting the show. So then when that Milkowski book came out, I read that's where his showcase was for that record for Bobby Columbia, right? Was at the Bottom Line.
Oh, really?
And I thought, this is like Bird not being allowed in Birdland.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Kind of, right?
Yeah, I understand the parallel. Wow, I didn't know that.
Like,
I haven't read that book in who knows, 15 years.
This is Maybe I didn't read it in the book. Maybe I saw it in that documentary.
I thought I remembered that when he went to go
audition or showcase for the guys of Columbia Records that was at Columbia Records because the dude from Columbia was hitting on his wife. And Jocko's wife was like, no, I'm married to the best bass player. And then the record guy was like, cool, have him come by my office if he's so great. And just showed up with no shoes and a bass and you did the Jocko thing.
I just remember seeing somewhere about him playing at the bottom line. And that was helped get his record deal, or maybe it was his first real showcase after the record came out. Because the Bottom Line was a great listening club.
Really?
Yeah, it was incredible. There was I saw some great, great acts there, and there was almost every seat. Sometimes you couldn't see so well, but here, every seat you could hear so well in the Bottom Line.
Oh man.
I saw Sonny Rollins at the Bottom Line. I saw George Jones at the Bottom Line.
Damn.
It was like, they really...
George Jones, like country George Jones?
Yes.
Wow.
He played the Bottom Line.
That's funny. I wouldn't expect George Jones and Sonny Rollins to be doing the same clubs.
I know.
Yeah.
But you know, back then, because Dylan talked about when they would play like the Village Gate, I think shows were going like all day, and they'd have, he said he would play, and then like Cecil Taylor would play after.
Really?
So even on the same day.
Was the Village Gate a venue, or was that that newspaper that was kind of going around the village in the, like the early 60s? What was the name of that newspaper?
The Village Voice?
Ah, that's what it was. Okay, yeah.
That's where you found out where everyone was playing.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That was great.
That was so great.
Yeah.
I mean, that's better than anything you can find online now.
Sure. Because it's all in one place. I mean, that's what's so great about one publication versus like a billion publications, and you don't even know which one to follow anymore.
That's how you got apartments.
Yeah.
That's how you got everything, the Village Voice. But the Village Gate was a venue on Bleecker Street that would have comedians.
Okay.
Like George Carlin, people like that. They'd have Odetta, all the folk people would play there, and all the jazz people.
Yeah.
And they would just take turns. There'd be not one jazz night. And then when I moved to New York, the Village Gate had the Latin meets jazz.
Okay.
And they'd have Latin bands with some great soloists, Michael Brecker, Randy Brecker, or Steve Turay, all these great jazz players would go play while people were dancing. Unbelievable Latin dancing.
Right.
With these great Latin bands playing, where a jazz guy would solo, would get up and just blow like it the Vanguard. Right. It was in front of a Latin band. That was happening when I moved to New York. There was one bass player I loved. I think it was Venezuelan, named Oscar De Leon. Oscar De Leon would play, and he'd play some of his stuff's on YouTube, old Oscar De Leon, and he'd play baby bass, and then he'd dance, and he had the greatest dance moves and sing.
Wow.
Playing with this really complicated rhythmic stuff to the, you know, to the clave.
Yeah.
I loved it. I've never seen anyone do that. Esperanza, I saw her there. She can do that.
Okay.
I've seen her sing.
Okay. singing, like playing off the clave like that.
Well, great bass.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's why she's who she is, because I've seen her play with, I always thought, oh, yeah, she plays. I've heard of her. Yeah, she's. Oh, yeah, this girl looks. And the first time I saw her play was with Bobby Hutcherson at the Vanguard, playing like Bobby's thing.
Bobby's thing.
Yes. Esperanza.
Super high octane.
And just modal and really just harmonically, not bebop.
Right.
Really modern. Like the way Bobby Hutcherson plays, the way his songs are. Because, you know, when Bobby Hutcherson played played with Mike Clark, drummer, played with Harold Land, right? Harold Land played with Bobby Hutcherson later on. Harold Land went from playing the Clifford Brown, Max Roach stuff, which is real hard bop, right?
Yeah, sure.
Completely changing his sound and leaping ahead into the more newer jazz thing. And Mike Clark said he thought he was going to be playing with Harold Land. This is back in the mid-60s. He thought he'd be playing more of a bebop thing. And Harold Land played more like later Coltrane stuff.
Yeah.
So Esperanza playing with Bobby Hutcherson, I opened my eyes and went, wow, this girl, really, she can play.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Tony, what do you got coming up the rest of the year, man? You're in town for a little while before you go back out on the road?
Yeah, I have some gigs coming up. The singer I used to play with, Robert Gordon, died a couple months ago. And so we have this cool tribute coming up for him. And the guitar player I played with, when I moved to New York, not only did I learn about playing jazz, but also playing rock and roll. I had never really played. I was coming from country and Western swing and playing a little jazz, but I had never really played real rock and roll. As a kid in high school, I played it. But so this guitar player, Chris Spedding, with Robert Gordon, Chris Spedding was a session player in London, like Jimmy Page and people like Pete Townsend. All respected Chris Spedding, and I learned to play a lot with Chris, just how to really approach rock, certain type of.
Okay.
I mean, I knew Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry, I learned playing with Chuck Berry. So Chris showed me things that, like, I've used them forever. And so I'm going to do a tour with him and Anton Figg, great drummer.
Oh, nice. Yeah, sure.
Coming up. So we got some shows coming up, and then I got to go do a record in Jamaica that I'll tell you about it when it's done.
Oh, yeah. Then, is that one of the projects? One of the
non-disclosure
projects?
And then let's see what else. Then some other stuff that I can't talk about. And then I think Bob will go back on tour at the end of March. But since COVID ended, I guess a year ago summer, I went to Italy with this folk singer named Tom Ciccone that I've recorded records with. And then I went to Texas three times to record with people. One of them, Asleep at the Wheel.
Okay.
We did the 50th anniversary record.
Nice.
Right? I was with them. I mean, they started in 71. So we do this 50th anniversary record. One of the songs that I recorded with him is nominated for a Grammy. Lyle Lovett sang on it.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I got an invitation to go to the Grammys, and which I probably won't be able to go. But that was nice.
When is that? Early February?
Yeah, February 5th. Because the last real Grammy, I mean, I have a Grammy from playing with them for, we recorded 1 o'clock Jump and got a Grammy, Best Country Final. And I've played on a lot of Grammy records, but I never actually got
the trophy
or even never got in. Congratulations, you're nominated for a Grammy
as
a player. Because when you're a sideman on records, you don't get that unless, and this is what people should do, list us bass players as special guest artists.
Right.
That way, we'll get a Grammy.
Yeah, instead of personnel.
Right, and that's what, like, I see Dave Holland puts on his records, featuring, right?
I've seen Pino featured on some records like that. Like, it'll be the artist featuring Pino Palladino.
Right, and that means, Pino should be featured.
Well, absolutely. I completely agree.
They should give him billing.
Yes, absolutely.
He's so great. But, like, that's how that's, because I have played on so many records that have won Grammys, but you don't get one. You could get a certificate if you wanted, I guess. But so that was nice to actually get that a couple of weeks ago. Congratulations on
That's cool.
So but I haven't played with them. I mean, we did this short tour last year, and that was fun. But then Bob started touring again. So Bob is, that's my main touring thing. I don't really have to do much other things.
Yeah.
And then with a young'un now.
Right. Yeah, that'll take up a lot of time.
It's tough, man.
Well, man, as these projects start getting released, as the documentary and some of these other recording projects, let me know. Come back on and talk about them when you're able to. I'd love to hear about them.
I will, yeah.
Cool, man. Tony, thanks so much, man.
Thank you, man, and good Absolutely. Luck with everything you're doing. And thanks for, you know, supporting the bass world so greatly. Oh,
thanks,
so
man. Incredible. Thanks. We'll be so in great. Touch. I want to have you back on and hear about the projects.
Okay, cool.
All right, kill it, man. Have All a good right. one.
Take care, man. Talk to All you right. later.
All right. That was my talk with Tony Garnet. Man, such a great hang. And like, with, I loved hearing about his just fascination about jazz. And him talking about it and talking about, you know, that he hasn't had the time to put into it. But clearly his career has still been really strong with a lot of incredibly impressive things. And I mean, he gets to play with a legend. That's pretty amazing. Huh? Playing with Bob Dylan doesn't suck. In addition to all the other folks he's played with and working on movie soundtracks and all these things, I'm really excited to have him back on the podcast when he can speak about some of the projects that are in the works. I'm looking to hear more from him about those things. If you are enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it. And that's all I got for this one, folks. That's all I got. I will catch you on the next one in a minute.